Very warm welcome to you to the latest in the now quinquennial series of Tyler lectures on the philosophy of the sciences. The origin of these lectures is somewhat mysterious. George Edward Tyler is an enigmatic figure. He's not known to have attended any university, let alone Cambridge. He did write a number of political, philosophical tracts with interesting titles such as Axioms and Postulates of Aesthetic, not pathetic or athletic, but aesthetic philosophy, A Future Roman Empire, and Unpopular Politics. This last one is actually available on Amazon, but it doesn't seem to have been bought by many, very people. He wrote other things too, but he resolved in 1916 to give £1,000 for a series of lectures on some aspects of the philosophy of sciences and the relation, or want of relation, between the different branches of knowledge. He chose to give the money to Trinity. It's not at all clear why, but of course we in Trinity are very sensible of his excellent taste in this regard. The lectures have taken place every 3 years until not so long ago when they were changed to 5 yearly, and the list of former speakers is very impressive. We had, to begin with, A.N. Whitehead, followed by C.D. Broad, Bertrand Russell, G.E. Moore, slightly more recently, Sir Arthur Eddington, to Martin Ryle, Freeman Dyson, Andrew Huxley, and most recently, the last four, Michael Redhead, Martin Rudwick, who I think is here, Simon Conway Morris, and Peter Gallison, and I hope some others of those four are here also today. Our lecturer this year is Simon Schaffer. He's presently Professor of the History and Philosophy of Science at Cambridge, and he was in fact an undergraduate at Trinity, so it's good to welcome him back to give a Trinity lecture. According to Wikipedia, no doubt correctly, he previously taught at Imperial College and UCLA before returning here a few years ago. Perhaps his most famous work has the title Leviathan and the Air Pump, Hobbes, Boyle and the Experimental Life, a book co-authored with Stephen Chapin, which won the very prestigious Erasmus Prize in 2005. He's also a very prolific writer of articles on the history and philosophy of science, 150 articles plus on a huge range of subjects, electrical showmen and Tory mystics, very appropriate for today perhaps, metrication and Victorian values. He's principally concerned with the periods of the 17th and 18th century. Now, just because he's written a lot of papers doesn't mean that these are just scattergun. Many of these articles have proved to be genuinely paradigm-shifting, representing crucial interventions in historical debate. He's at ease in a wide range of fields, from psychology through physics to anthropology and imperial history. And he's widely respected both by the sociologists of knowledge and by real-life scientists, which is no mean achievement. He's also very well known as a communicator on the history of science. He's appeared on television as presenter, most famously, of the series The Light Fantastic, also regularly on the radio. And a quick search of Google reveals he's also a star of YouTube. In fact, he's so well known internationally, and so many admirers far from Cambridge have professed themselves disappointed not to be here today and for his subsequent lectures, that an audio podcast is to be made of this series. So that once again, we can thank Simon Schaffer for a paradigm-shifting intervention. The general title of the series is When the Stars Throw Down Their Spears, Histories of Astronomy and Empire. And I'm very pleased to invite Simon Schaffer to deliver his first lecture on A Pattern Science.
I don't know how to go on. It's a serious problem. One of the commonest tricks of the philosophy of science, which I espouse, is to make going on in a series look harder, or at least stranger, than it might at first appear. One familiar continuation of the series, 2, 4, 6, 8, is in your culture 10, and in my culture, who do we appreciate? We ask, in my culture, how members of a language game learn how to apply a rule. The path taken turns out to depend on locale, on precedence, and their ingenious development. The world is full, as we will discover in the next 4 weeks, of members of the awkward squad who can't be easily induced to go on in the way we would expect or want or predict. At the very start of the very first Tana lectures in autumn 1919, Alfred North Whitehead, whom the Vice Master mentioned, put the problem pithily and characteristically elegantly. Whitehead said, "In the lecture form, a single line of communication from premise to conclusion is never sufficient for intelligibility. The audience will construe whatever one says into conformity with their pre-existing outlook." And you will. As you've already heard, there's something embarrassing, flattering, and uncanny about continuing the Tana series, not least because of George Edward Tana's intriguing agenda. His aesthetic philosophy, aimed at the advancement of knowledge by the distinction of its incommensurable provinces, and in particular, Tana was involved in a counterblast to what he called, in 1916, the disproportionate prominence at present accorded to the provinces of physical science, unquote. His manifesto defended creationism, miracles, the incarnation, resurrection, angels, and he denounced the appearance in place of university theology of more secular, but it must be said for me, more appealing disciplines such as brewing at the University of Birmingham and dyeing with an E at the University of Leeds. That's not what I'm going to continue. Whitehead's lectures are part of my prompt. I should say that every time I show you a philosopher in this series, the philosopher will be sitting down, because rather like British triumphs in the Olympics, this nation's philosophical culture does best when its members are seated. Whitehead was at least equally concerned with the disproportionate status of physical sciences, astronomy, I think, in particular, and to answer the timely questions, the very timely questions, of going on, of survival, of how anything in this world, we are in November 1919, could possibly continue. His lectures were in that sense, and many others, militant. He recalls, "They were thought out and written amidst the sound of guns. Guns of Kitchener's army training on Salisbury Plain. Guns on the Somme, faintly echoing across the Sussex coast. Some few parts of my lectures composed to pass times of expectation during air raids over London, punctuated by the sound of bombs and the answer of artillery, with my arguments clipped by the whirr of aeroplanes." Nor at that moment in the autumn of 1919, when the lectures were given here, were the sciences themselves obviously stable or constant. It wasn't obvious what was going to survive. The Tana lectures were delivered essentially as Whitehead was commuting between Cambridge and London, where he attended the portentous joint meeting of the Royal Society and the Royal Astronomical Society in early November, at which Dyson, the Astronomer Royal, and Eddington, the Plumian Professor, presented their solar eclipse data for Einstein's general theory of relativity, a meeting of which Whitehead gives by far the most interesting and most important description, which I'll come back to, I've just discovered, in Lecture 4. The whole atmosphere of tense interest was exactly like that of Greek drama, Whitehead says. So what were these lectures? They were called the Concept of Nature. They were an attack on what he called, as you see, the facile vice of bifurcation, the division of nature into properties such as figure and extension, proper to the physical sciences, roughly speaking, primary qualities, and those that could not be managed under an exhaustive and limited register, such as colour or taste, called secondary qualities. Whitehead's attempt to replace this great bifurcation with a better philosophy of process and event was precisely to be pursued on condition that it made sense of the remarkable fact that anything at all in the world survives, that it goes on. During the Cold War, matters got spookier. In 1949, the Oxford philosopher Gilbert Ryle notoriously condemned doctrines of the ghost in the machine. For him, questions about the relations between people's bodies and their minds were improper in, as he put it, much the same way as is the question what transactions go on between the House of Commons and the British Constitution. In 1954, having scotched, as it were, the basis of the Great Bifurcation, Ryle used his Tanner lectures to expand on his loathing for this kind of dualism. He described, as you see, those of you at least sitting in the middle, see, what he calls the poison pen effect. I adore this phrase, in which those who hold the world to be exhaustively that of the astronomers, and he meant Eddington, were constantly telling their audience that nothing in the world is truly as it seemed. Eddington is the Miss Marple of dualism. Astronomy's ontology became little more, according to Ryle, than a kind of widely diffused and scientifically authorized conspiracy theory. And in a telling phrase that I've reproduced here, he applies the moral to the history of the sciences. According to the scientists, since, I quote, scientific truths are about what can carry and be carried by calculations, unquote, anything else is inauthentic and illusory and belongs to a world elsewhere. Historians of the sciences, like me, used to assume their task was to tell dramatic stories about the long-term advance of these truths of calculation. Our discipline's textbooks are still full of grand narratives of the liberation of the truths of science from the errors of the everyday. Indeed, as Michel Foucault argued, anyone envisaging the analysis of discourse solely in terms of the continuity of time would inevitably be led to approach and analyze it like the internal transformation of an individual consciousness. No one analyzed the transformations of individual consciousnesses better than the professor of geography at the University of Königsberg, Immanuel Kant. And I reproduce here, I won't read it out, a lengthy, slightly filleted citation that I often use from the first critique, from the Critique of Pure Reason, written in the wake, amongst other things, of Kant's reading of Georg Forster's description of voyaging with Captain Cook. This is a description by Kant of the kingdom of truth that he will analyze. And the metaphors which Kant uses to analyze the kingdom of truth are copied over explicitly from precisely the kind of geography, travel, voyaging, and empire which will be the burden of my lectures. By what title we possess this land itself, and how we hold it secure against all hostile claims. The relation here between space and knowledge is, of course, much more than a metaphor. The positional astronomy, the meridian astronomy, which was practiced and in many ways founded by Kant's greatest scientific colleague at Königsberg, Friedrich Bessel, argued that the orientation of the exquisitely positioned observer was the fundamental enterprise of the exact sciences. Hence Kant's great question of 1786, what is orientation in thinking? This fundamental question was posed just as the sciences, the astronomical as well as the medical, had then at last begun to master space, the spatialized productive body, the spatialized imperial meridian. The marked transformation, then, of the decades around 1800, Chris Bailey has taught us to call precisely the imperial meridian, was on the one hand the moment when the sciences were constructed as specialist enterprises of spatial management, and on the other hand, the moment when a metaphysical temporality began to govern, completely govern, the way in which stories were told about the sciences' development. In other words, it was a set of changes in the space organization of the sciences that allowed and was supported by a specifically temporalized mode for the historiography of the sciences. It's therefore, it seems to me, interesting, which is Cambridge philosophy speak for really important, to reflect on what happens if we interpret Whitehead's bifurcation literally, which is what I'm going to do in these lectures, as the deliberate geographical production of a defined region for the sciences seemingly to be sundered from everyday experience. This is what the sociologist Michel Callin has called the great confinement of the sciences, clearly analogous to Foucault's work on madness. And for sociologists of science, astronomy has often provided the classic case of confinement and withdrawal. Callin, in his work on acting in an uncertain society, describes the ascent of this observatory in the extreme south of France, the Pic du Midi. I show you first its construction on the Pic de Bigorre and its current advertising campaign, and a citation from Callin. The observatory was conceived to allow a reclusive life, cut off from the rest of the world. The long path we followed wasn't destined to carry us to wide open spaces, but rather to distance us from them, and this wrenching apart is nowhere more spectacular than in the case of astronomy. And the histories of astronomy bear that out in large measure. The histories of astronomy, which I will recount, are often histories of, as it seems, confinement. This is the Illustrated London News image of the observation of the transit of Venus at Hawaii, on Oahu, in the end of 1874, with a quote from the expedition's commander, George Tupman: "A superb cloudless day, our joy is great. A detachment of 12 marines came to keep the ground. There was a general feeling among the native population the observatories would be open to the public. Hundreds came to the gates in their holiday clothes. The sight of the redcoats had the desired effect." It's those redcoats, it seems to me, that contain a clue as to the relationship between bifurcation, calculation, astronomy, and geography. Astronomers construct well-accounted workshops that must also be watchtowers. They tell their audience, as did an eminent American astronomy lecturer in 1850, that, I quote, but not with the right accent, "The astronomer has ever lived and never dies. The sentinel upon the watchtower is relieved from duty, but another takes his place, and the vigil is unbroken. The deluge sweeps from the earth its inhabitants, but when the storm is hushed from the summit of Mount Ararat, the astronomer resumes his endless vigils." I'll be talking about the gender of that sentence in Lecture 3, it turns out, and now I want to emphasize that it seems essential here to assert the isolated seclusion and the collective discipline of this strange mountaintop.
The watchtowers of science, it's the same lecturer, now cover the whole earth, and the sentinels never sleep. This seems to me to be part of the ancestry of astronomy's power and of the sheer difficulty of writing the genealogy of that power. In that sense, Whitehead's great bifurcation works because it systematically identifies the production and reproduction of the measures needed to get access to distant things with the way those things really subsist in the world. The great bifurcation works because it systematically identifies the production and reproduction of the measures needed to get access to distant things with the way those things actually subsist in the world. What is in fact the result of immense social labour is attributed to the world's inertia. There's a systematic reliance on, then concealment or disappearance or suspicion of, all the mediating networks which link the work of the observatory and all other entities. We historians of science are much, much more familiar with this in the case of natural history. Here I'm showing you a map of Joseph Banks's botanical network circa 1790 to 1800, which show you almost all, I notice now, the sources of the plant specimens that he gathered in Soho Square and at Kew, and the destination of large numbers of the transplantations he organised from the imperial capital, as Richard Drayton has taught us so well. But we're less familiar, I'm desperately hoping, with the same kind of map that can be drawn for astronomers. This is a map of all the sources of data Isaac Newton uses in the third book of Principia Mathematica. We're used to thinking of Newton in Trinity as the isolate supreme, as the analyst in the cloister. We forget, and I'm interested how we forget, the global reach of the Newtonian network and the implication of the greatest work in the history of the sciences, the Principia, on the imperial, colonial, and global trade networks of the period 1660 to 1700. And the example can be multiplied. The late 18th century astronomer in this country, most distinguished for his isolation, so distinguished for his isolation that the absurd enterprise of retrospective diagnosis has subjected Henry Cavendish to the diagnosis of extreme autism, simply because he couldn't think of anything to say to William Herschel when they had dinner together. Isolation in Cavendish's case was a scientific necessity looked at from one point of view. These are his, what he called his experiments to determine the density of the Earth, that's to say to measure the gravitational constant that he carried out in Clapham, since you ask, in 1798, in a carefully constructed, isolated room to which access was only possible via the telescopes you see at bottom left and bottom right. But if you do the same exercise as I've just done for Newton, you get a very similar map. In order to conduct those experiments and make sense of them, all the data that Cavendish was using up to 1798 is globally distributed thanks to the Royal Africa Company, the East India Company, and the Hudson's Bay Companies in particular. But this argument that there's an historical geography of essential value for understanding astronomy's global power is not popular. Thank goodness. In his inaugural lecture at the Australian National University in 1953, the Cambridge-trained geographer Oscar Speight imagined what he called a geography of astronomy. He goes on to insist, does Speight, that such a geography would be extraordinarily limited. And in this splendid sentence, Speight argues, only on an absurdly a priori theory would a study of astronomical technique have to take a geographical view. So my theory in these lectures is absurdly a priori. And the point of these lectures is to turn them into a posteriori theories. Not only that, but a range of historians of imperial sciences, I will spare their blushes by not naming them, have argued that while it may well be true that economic botany, meteorology, geodesy have played important roles in imperial policy, this is not true for the exact sciences of physics or astronomy. They've written, there is no evidence that physics or astronomy played any significant role in British imperial policy or colonial rule. They've written that, and I quote, those who achieved distinction overseas in the exact sciences, wait for it, did so by staying beyond the reach of the imperialist octopus that moved men across oceans to satisfy metropolitan appetites. That's three mixed metaphors in one sentence. Now, it seems, in a certain sense, trivial to refute those bold conjectures. It's evident that the astronomy of the High Enlightenment and the imperial meridian contributed essentially to imperial projects. Longitude, above all, plays that role. So what I've done here is to reproduce the Astronomer Royal Neville Maskelyne's nautical almanac for the late 18th century, for the year in the late 18th century, and annotated it according to the protocol that Maskelyne and his allies from the late 18th century invited mariners to run through in order to work from the time by their chronometer and their measured lunar distance to their exact longitude from Greenwich. It was devices like these. This is a double-frame sextant made by the great London makers, John and Edward Troughton, in 1797, held at the National Maritime Museum, simply to reinforce the intimate connection, surely, between British imperial policy and colonial rule on the one hand, and on the other, the role of astronomy. And the great Transit of Venus projects of the 1760s, 1761, I've marked here on these maps every European recorded observation of the Venus transit of 61 and then the Venus transit of 69, which was the primer, the absurdly a priori rationale for Cook and his men to sail to Tahiti in Polynesia. Now, in the balance of the time of this lecture, what I want to do is to use cases from the new penal colony set up by the British in New South Wales in 1788 to explore the intricate relations between these kinds of long-range networks of supply and exchange, on the one hand, and the achievement and failure of astronomy to survive in a bifurcated world. I notice, as I read through the lectures in advance, that most of the cases which I will present you with in these Lenten talks will be talks about failure. And I'll reflect right at the end of the series on why that is. I want to follow recent arguments about the interactions between political imagination and techno-scientific transformation. I want to suggest here that an enterprise such as positional meridian astronomy relied on and helped further imperial projects. At least as significantly, these transformations reshaped the direction and content of those projects and their aims. But I have to start in Trinity. This is William Whewell, polymath extraordinaire. It's from him that I've borrowed the phrase pattern science. In late 1834, Whewell, then much preoccupied with writing the history of the sciences from a philosophically informed perspective, insisted that astronomy is, of course, my pattern science. Now, important for Whewell and for me is the fact that by no means all of what we now think of as the astronomical sciences were his pattern. It was a very particular mix of celestial mechanics and meridian astronomy that was the pattern. Because it was that mix that, as you see in the second quote, had provided the first example of the formation of a perfect inductive science, by which he meant a science which had achieved permanence, a science whose history had ended. A science now cast into such perfect deductive form under a single fundamental idea that only further empirical correction would be required, and in that sense, astronomy was finished. In this sense, too, Friedrich Bessel, Kant's great colleague at Königsberg, defined what perfect astronomy, what pattern astronomy was. Now, what astronomy must do, says Bessel, has always been clear, and it has now done it. It must lay down the rules for determining the motions of the heavenly bodies as they appear to us from Earth. Everything else that can be learnt about the heavenly bodies is not of any astronomical interest at all. Unquote. And in later lectures, I'll return to that great embargo, which will be transgressed in the 1800s, notably within the great, possibly the greatest of colonial astronomies, astrophysics. But what we begin to see is that the great bifurcation at that moment, 200 years ago, was indeed best exemplified by this astronomy's condition. This is the French interior minister, better known to you as probably the greatest astronomer of the High Enlightenment, Pierre-Simon Laplace, and the beginning of his exposition of the system of the world of 1797, in which he articulates what kind of bifurcation the perfect science depends upon. It is a very long way from the first view of the sky to the general view through which one grasps the past and future states of the system of the world. And this Laplacian view of the embargo and of the bifurcation is reproduced everywhere in the observatory system of the early 1800s. Here at Cambridge, for example, the first head of the university's astronomical observatory, Robert Woodhouse, insists that astronomy, and I quote, has reached a kind of maximum state of excellence, and that therefore astronomical observatories brought philosophical and intellectual benefits by reinforcing permanence in a revolutionary age. They become, says Professor Woodhouse, sanctuaries of moral control and the zealous discharge of duty. This is an image made by the young and brilliant Charles Piazzi Smythe of Dad at the telescope. Dad is Admiral W.H. Smythe, one of England's leading amateur astronomers in the 1830s, using a Thomas Jones transit instrument and a clock to measure the transit of a star across the meridian line. This is the fundamental act of meridian astronomy, the perfect science. The business of the practical astronomer, I'm quoting from a very widely read period description of such observations, when he is satisfied that the proper object is passing the field, is to count and mark down the exact second and fractional part of the second indicated by the clock, having its dial illuminated and its beat audible at the instance when such an object is bisected by each successive vertical wire in the eyepiece. In this discrimination consists the excellence of the observation. more brutally, the great Victorian Astronomer Royal, George Airy, summed up what kind of work this is. The ideal of an observer of the highest class is a compound of a watchmaker and a banker's clerk. Readers of the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge's Penny Cyclopedia at this period were pithily instructed, "For observatory, see transit instrument." Unquote. So there was a basic relation between astronomy's epistemic pattern, that's to say what kind of knowledge it stood for and made, its disciplined labour pattern, and its safe isolation. The aim was to make autonomy so as to encompass the world. In his work on astronomy for the Cabinet Cyclopedia, published just before he left England for his heroic astronomical programme at the Cape of Good Hope in late 1833, John Herschel influentially set out what he saw as the right relationship between astronomers, instruments, and makers. And I've cited the guts of it here. It must be constantly the aim of the astronomer to make himself independent of the imperfections incident to every work the artist can place in his hands. The period's leading astronomers consistently urged the need to free their work from such idiosyncrasies, as in the very same gesture they increasingly depend on their output. But in an epoch of factional struggle in the politics of the sciences, the principal makers never understood themselves as servants. Rather, they were partners and not infrequently judges. The wealthy amateur astronomer in London, James South, was peculiarly and publicly alert to the insufficiencies even of reliable instruments when installed remotely. You have here part of a print South made of what he did to the instrument Troughton sold him at his observatory in Campden Hill, which was to break it up and sell it for scrap. You also have an extract from one of South's very large number of letters to the newspaper denouncing the government, instrument makers, other astronomers, and especially colonial astronomers. I'll read this out because people sitting over there really need this quote. "It was very probably imagined by government that nothing more was necessary than the mere placing the instruments on their respective piers. As well might they have supposed that desks, pens, ink and paper would make cabinet ministers, as that astronomical instruments per se would produce astronomical observations." It was exactly this period too, from the 1820s on, that, partly under the aegis of the Board of Longitude, partly under the aegis of private initiatives sponsored by the Colonial Office, that a large number of overseas colonial observatories are set up. And each of these observatories have disastrous, appalling, troubled careers centering on, precisely, the relations of distance, autonomy, and control required for their output to count as perfect science. At the Cape, the observatory was built by, and as you see from this extraordinary letter from the astronomer at the Cape, Theron Fellows, often staffed by slaves. In Bombay, an observatory was built by the East India Company in 1823. An astronomer was hired from London's East End. He was sent a group of instruments made by the company's official makers. He sent them all back in two large cases. They were tried in London and found to be just fine. He was sacked. He reckoned that your instrument makers are no more capable of making an instrument such as I have applied for than they are of flying to the moon. And he moved to run the Mint in Calcutta, with equally disastrous consequences. Controversies about the viability of what we might call acting at a distance were the stuff of physics and politics at this period. As the political historian Duncan Bell has recently argued, I think very persuasively, changes in the techniques of mastering distance indeed seem to assault the staple categories of Newtonian physics and Kantian metaphysics. They also assaulted, one must add, the categories of metropolitan debate. There's one final project within this pattern science that needs emphasis: reduction. The key to colonial astronomy was to arrange networks and supply lines so that those networks and supply lines became completely invisible. Astronomical work would be reduced by identifying equations to standardise data. And here you have a page from the so-called Brisbane Catalogue of Stars, which I'll be describing in a moment, with observations reduced to a common epoch. George Airy rated reduction far above mere observation. Why? Because, says Airy, and I quote, "an idiot with a few days' practice may observe very well," unquote. Collective celestial surveys, especially in the colonial system, could perhaps, this was the aim, be transformed into something like the uncanny vision of a single eye, EYE. This was a fantasy of the entire contents of heaven ordered into classes and reduced to a moment outside time, the view from nowhere. Such a godlike and singular view, confined from the world so as to know it, became an indispensable resource throughout public culture. Epoch, period, revolution, zenith became historians' words, as well as astronomers. Some wrote, as Ian Hacking, previous Tarna lecturer, has pointed out, of what was then called an astronomical conception of society. Charles Dickens' dark satire of calculation in Hard Times notoriously imagines an astronomical observatory without any windows, where the astronomer within would arrange the starry universe solely by pen, ink, and paper. So, precise celestial knowledge had, of course, long seemed a crucial tool of colonial power, a sign of that power's legitimacy, a rationale for its exercise. Successive British expeditions into the Pacific, for example, mixed up stories of measured prowess, of solitary travel, and of territorial command. They often did so by focusing on hardware, on instruments especially. The instruments and hardware of Polynesian and Micronesian navigators were those that peculiarly impressed British astronomers and navigators such as William Wales or William Bailey when they entered the Pacific on Captain Cook's voyages. You have here on the left a Micronesian sailing tool, navigational tool, and on the right, very celebrated image of the map made for Cook and his astronomers by the Tahitian priest and navigator Tupaia. Yet, while recognising indigenous capacity through the instruments and hardware they made, astronomers often, in fact always, advertised themselves as solitary, even and precisely when their work is pursued in the midst of large numbers of colleagues and of hosts. Here is Madras Observatory illustrated in the early 1820s with the great pillar on the right holding the transit instrument and two Tamil Brahmins and the observer determining the rate of going of a seconds pendulum and thus the figure of the earth. The pillar bore this inscription: "Posterity will be informed 1,000 years hence of the period when the mathematical sciences were first planted by British liberality in Asia." So for the final section of my talk, I want to pursue all those themes in the Australian case, the New South Wales case. The Pacific in 1790, with some of the more salient British entrants into the Pacific marked, as well as the fatal voyage of La Pérouse. Vancouver, whom I'll be talking about in a later lecture, McCartney, and the astronomer whom I want to talk about now, William Dawes. William Dawes was the astronomer who accompanied the First Fleet and who surveyed the new penal colony between 1788 and 1791. I'm interested in William Dawes following the superb work of my friend and colleague David Turnbull on his interaction with the indigenous peoples of this part of Australia. In April of 1791, during a long trek from Parramatta, Dawes was guided by two Eora, Aborigines from the coast, expert fishermen, possum hunters. Their names were Colby and Baladery. British surveyors, led by Dawes, learnt that, quote, to convey to their understandings the intention of our journey was impossible, for perhaps no words can unfold to a native the motives of curiosity which induce men to encounter labour, fatigue and pain when they might remain in repose at home with a sufficiency of food. And that's my question too. I want to know why Dawes was walking west from Parramatta. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, Colby and Baladery were particularly impressed by two things about Dawes. One was that his food was really, really awful, and he acquired the name in Eora, Shit Eater. On the other hand, they were impressed by his instruments, his telescope, his compass, which they called Na Moro, which literally means waywiser. So for them, the astronomer William Dawes is a badly supplied but ingenious traveller. With Dawes' skillful geometry, conducted without a pause or halt in conversation, we always knew exactly where we were and how far from home. And behind that technique lay this, the new observatory that Dawes built, this is his description, sent home to the Astronomer Royal Maskelyne at the end of 1790, beginning of 1791. Dawes feared the colony wouldn't last, but he sought the permanence which his meridian astronomy could give. He put a John Bird quadrant, a Dollond achromatic, and a magnificent clock by John Shelton into the observatory and began to give Australia time. Indeed, it's exactly at this moment, according to a book that never lies, the Australian National Dictionary, that the phrase doing time is first used in English. The phrase doing time was invented in Port Jackson in New South Wales in 1791 and 1792 in conversation between the convicts down in the harbour and Dawes's instruments up on the hill. A second episode illustrates the kind of interactions and networking which will preoccupy us in this lecture. This is a portrait of Thomas McDougall Brisbane, veteran Scottish soldier and savant, governor of New South Wales. The picture was made in 1825 by the professional artist Augustus Earle, who enters history more famously a decade later as one of the artists on board HMS Beagle, which I think you may have heard too much about. Brisbane was well known, if not notorious, as you see in this appalling reproduction of the painting now hanging in Government House in Sydney, as an astronomer. During his service in Wellington's army, he'd worked with Laplace in Paris and learnt meridian astronomy. In early 22, he founded the penal colony's first permanent observatory to replace that of Dawes in the grounds of Government House at Parramatta. He shipped superb instruments from Scotland and from London. This is his equatorial, which survives in the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. And he hired Augustus Earle's old friend, Rümke, great German astronomer, as his observer, and an ingenious Scottish handloom weaver, James Dunlop, as his assistant. But relations between the men soon collapsed. Brisbane's errant administration earned the governor a stiff recall to Britain. Before he departed, Earl was given by Brisbane his litho press, and Earl used it to market images not only of colonial worthies, but of this man, the Aboriginal leader, the chief go-between, who worked between the settlers and the Aborigines, Bungaree, leader of the Broken Bay, the Carrigal people. This man was the first Aborigine to circumnavigate Australia. He was a guide and interpreter on board Flinders voyages. And as David Turnbull has recently reminded us, he became a symbolic and real interlocutor for a host of expeditions which reached Sydney in this period. The image you have here by Earl is of Bungaree standing on the site of William Dawes Observatory. You're looking eastwards across what's now the Rocks and Sydney Harbour to where the Opera House now is, and you see the British fleet commanded by Thomas Brisbane's cousin James Brisbane anchored in the harbour. It's said that when Bungaree went on board James Brisbane's vessel, he, Bungaree, was told that the commander was Brisbane, and Bungaree walked the deck, spoke to several officers, and taking a telescope from the hand of the midshipman, looked through it into the heavens, like this, and exclaimed, "Ah!" The Commodore was so struck with Bungaree's imitation of his cousin that he stood aghast, while the officers, unable to preserve their gravity, indulged in a hearty peal of laughter. The story reached England through Charles Dickens' journal, All the Year Round, in the same issue as the issue that launched A Tale of Two Cities. There's the story, Bungaree, King of the Blacks. It not only tells the story I've just told you, it also, very intriguingly, announces the fact that thanks to Bungaree's influence, Aboriginal bush calls have now become common amongst the students of Trinity College, Cambridge. I introduced these two tales because I wanted to emphasise the way in which instruments function as signs and go-betweens. In other words, within the colonial astronomical network, hardware and disciplined behaviour kept networks in play. In that sense, these networks were very like the other networks on which the imperial colonies, such as that in New South Wales, depended. Just as the observatory at the Cape was built by slaves, the observatory at Parramatta was built by convicts, and its fate was as ghastly as that of the observatory at the Cape. Brisbane himself was ambitious for his observatory. Here's his plan. As Jim Bennett has taught us, every Meridian observatory at this period has a neoclassical facade. Parramatta was no exception, with divided space for clock and for transit observations. And its initial output was indeed remarkable. This is the Dunlop and Brisbane catalogue of southern stars and nebulae, which earned the astronomers a medal from the new Astronomical Society of London. But despite its almost perfect isolation, its confinement and its bifurcation, Parramatta completely foundered. It was simultaneously too remote and too leaky, too well connected to parasites, not well enough connected to its allies and its suppliers. Part of the problem was internal parasitism. Rümker took all of the observing books away from the observatory to his own convict farm in 1823 and would not give them back, despite being threatened by Brisbane's magistrates and police. Dunlop was summoned back to London with Brisbane in order to, and I quote, expose the system of jobbing and peculation which appears to have been carried on under the colour of the patronial garb of science. And the news, we're now in 1829, 1830, soon reached the activists and reformers in London, led by Brisbane's great friend, the Cambridge professor Charles Babbage, who wrote a whole chapter in his masterpiece Reflections on the Decline of Science in England about the disasters of Parramatta Observatory, the failures of colonial government adequately to resource it, and how unreliable German astronomers are. I really look on it as an injury done to science generally because it takes away one of the rewards of those who in future times might be induced to emulate the splendid example afforded to the government of our numerous colonies. But there was a second problem, much more familiar to Australians, which is that the observatory, and I think in this respect it's almost unique in the history of astronomy, had to close because it was eaten. E-A-T-E-N. A commission of inquiry into the observatory's state reported that the floor and partitions of the building had been entirely destroyed by the white ant. So had most of the observing books. And indeed, let me add parenthetically, that the observing books now held partly in the Board of Longitude collection in the University Library in Cambridge and partly at the Royal Astronomical Society's library in Burlington House still have termite holes in them. Within a year, Dunlop was dead, Parramatta Observatory finished, and I quote here from the great New South Wales cometographer John Tebbutt eulogising at the end of the century about Parramatta's fate. What you see on the left, this is a fantastically beautiful photo by one of the 20th century's greatest photographers, Frank Hurley, famous for his work in polar science and in New Guinea. This is a photograph of Parramatta looking down the hill towards the city, towards Sydney. On the left is the obelisk, which was put up, in fact, to mark the transit instrument of Parramatta Observatory, put up in rather obviously, as you can see, in the wrong place, because the piers of the transit instrument are what you can see on the right. Often as I have stood there in the quiet solitude of the place, have I called up to memory the patient toiling of those three representatives of the stars, Brisbane, Rumker, Dunlop. So, let me conclude. I've described here the fate of one observatory in particular, but it could be generalised. Images of isolation completely misrepresent how the pattern science functioned in that epoch, though that science, like many other colonial projects, maintained self-sufficiency as aim. When Parramatta shut, experts worried that its books, though of value to an observatory, would fetch little more than waste paper if auctioned locally. There are instruments that would scarcely realise here in Sydney the value of their weight in metal, they wrote. Without the support systems provided by the Empire, they also always helped sustain the hardware and the software of colonial astronomy transmuted into scrap. The colonial science of astronomy simply could not go on. Thank you.
Take a few questions. Is this the only observatory by ants?
The only other observatory I know that was eaten by ants was actually John Tebbutt's observatory, the man who wrote the eulogy that I quoted, so he knew of what he was writing. There's a sense in which white ants, termites, are the hero of my first lecture, yes? White ant is Australian slang for corruption. Now, so to be white-anted is to be corrupted from within. On the other hand, absent white ants, Australian soils become extraordinarily infertile.
White ants are one of the chief ecological agents, by eating out the hearts of eucalypts, that make Australian soil capable of sustaining crops at all, and they produce didgeridoos with help from others. One knows that one has bought an authentic didgeridoo if it has termite holes down it, because that's how these hollow tubes appear. So, in that sense, white ant dreaming, I suddenly realise, is really one of the themes of this talk. What I wanted to say was that it's extraordinarily unlikely that simple autonomy and isolation are the unique, necessary and sufficient condition for producing science anywhere and anywhen, everywhere and everywhen. What I'll go on to discuss in future lectures, please don't give them up for Lent, is how it comes to pass that a whole range of projects in imperial and colonial astronomy, projects with great epistemic heft, both rely on and in interesting ways occlude the kind of networks that make astronomy survive in such a place as Parramatta or the Cape. I can say a little more about that. My source is a magnificent book whose author I'm blanking on. The book is called The Unforgiving Minute, Melbourne historian? No. Which is a social history of Australian time, which I strongly recommend to those of you interested in the history and philosophy of temporality. The opening chapters, for obvious reasons, juxtapose various ethnographies of Aboriginal time, especially Southwest Aboriginal time, with the temporalities of the penal system, first in Sydney and then, much more importantly, in Hobart, in Port Arthur, probably the largest single panoptic system in the British Empire at this period, in the 1820s and 30s. It was very much under Brisbane's and Macquarie's aegis that this was set up. So doing time becomes a very general term by the 1840s. It's in Dickens already in the 1840s and 50s. It's in Great Expectations for, first of all, transportation and then incarceration. But first of all, transportation and then incarceration, which is rather my point. Right?
One or two other animal stories.
I knew that we'd get some good ones if you were here.
The telescope was eaten by rodents.
Oh, really?
And the Penticton radio telescope, well, with lots of wires, was destroyed by elks running through it.
And do elks have peculiarly telltale radio signals?
It must have been quite a scene.
Exactly. Yeah.
I was going to ask about the third area of geography, which was the Hudson Bay Company. Were there any redeeming features there?
What do you mean, redeeming? Some of my best friends are from Canada.
Disaster in Australia.
I understand the question. Okay, there are three things to say about that. First of all, the Hudson's Bay Company in the period where around which I referred to it, that's to say the period of Henry Cavendish's work, the late 18th century from 1770 to 1790, is indispensable as a resource for a large set of projects in British, imperial and global sciences, in thermometry notoriously. So Henry Cavendish's work on heat and cold is completely reliant on his informants amongst the factors at the bottom of the bay in Fort Churchill and Fort York. More significantly, for our interests here, perhaps, the company also massively resourced, relatively massively resourced, the Transit of Venus programs of 61 and 69, which had major bases in the north, including those dispatched from Massachusetts, but also those sent from Britain via Orkney into the bay. So the company already in the middle to late 18th century is very much part of the kind of network of which I was describing. A second answer is, and I haven't had time here, but I'll come back to this in a later lecture,
is to think about the role of British American, what we now call Canadian astronomy and geodesy, that Suzanne Zeller has discussed in her work, in what one might call the co-production of the landmass of British North America and the astronomical surveying that goes along with that. And the company plays an absolutely critical role there, notably in supplying, if that's a bit of a euphemism, support staff. The final, and again I'll come back to this next week, role that the company, that HBC plays in this story, is to do with shipping, with navigation. I haven't attended here, I will in the next lecture, to the role of the Marine and of the Maritime and of the Navy in the kinds of astronomy that concern me, and the provision of a vast reserve army of surveyors, observers, and so forth for the kinds of astronomical projects that we're interested in. That's for the historical side of the talks.
How does the isolation of the astronomer relate to isolation of other sciences, like botanist or photographer?
That's a very good question. So the question is, how does the isolation of the astronomer relate to isolation of other kinds of scientist? Well, I think in several different kinds of ways. First, one of the things that I tried to suggest in the front half of the talk here is that astronomy becomes, in the version of astronomy that we're interested in, around 1800, a pattern science, because it is perfected in both senses of perfection. That's to say, it is complete, its history is finished, and it's perfect in the sense that it relies on intense forms of isolation. One way in which that's articulated, I'll be talking about this in lecture 3, is to say, this is very much the Laplacian view, that the virtues of astronomy are entirely cognate with the fact that astronomers do not do experiments. That, as it were, the observatory is represented, in public at least, as a kind of institutionalized retina, so that the reduction of data to a single epoch and a single place, and the impossibility of manipulating the source of that data experimentally, is advertised by Laplace, for example, as one of the most important virtues of the pattern science. So there, the isolation of a particular kind of astronomy, this is not true of all astronomy, right? The isolation of a particular kind of astronomical project goes along with the advertisement of its virtue. And the contrast is therefore drawn, and it is drawn by figures like Bessel and like Laplace for different reasons, with experimental chemistry, so that the isolation of the laboratory is rather distinguished, say, from the isolation of the observatory in ways that I evoked in that absurd piece of high-flown rhetoric from Ormsby Mitchell about Ararat and the flood, right, which is a piece of prose you do not find in 19th century statements about the virtues of physics or biology. Okay, so that's one way of thinking the comparison. But a different way of thinking the comparison is precisely to say that we want to think about other forms of astronomy as versions of field science, that historically they were exactly as isolated and exactly as networked and leaky as the way we normally think about 19th century field sciences, whether they be the field sciences of botany and zoology, or, as I will be keen to emphasize in these lectures, the eventually emergent field science of anthropology. So, on the one hand, a certain kind of ideology which advertises astronomy's unique status. On the other hand, an historical approach which is very skeptical of that ideology and then has to ask itself whence the tone of voice that the ideology is so often accompanied with. Right? That's been the concern, at least, of the first half of this lecture. There's much more to say about that. For example, in the case where I juxtaposed Banks and his network with Newton, and his, right, there's much more finesse required fully to make sense of what's going on in the differences and similarities between those two maps. Right? But that's the pithiest I can be at the moment.
I'm wondering whether, just going back to the Whitehead bifurcation quotation that you started with, and how he starts his list of what's separated out with color. And I'm wondering whether Tewell and others a century earlier would have had the same list of secondary qualities or things that are divided, or whether the history of what is a secondary quality is involved in this shift too.
Yeah, there is a history to be written, and absolutely. I mean, there is a history to be written of what counts as a secondary quality. Historians of science, I'm teaching you to suck eggs, have written this history principally in the name of a certain kind of history of affect, of sensuality, and of the body. Right? So if one thinks of work like that of our colleague Lisa Roberts on the case of 18th and early 19th century chemistry, she's argued that what happens in the period of the chemical revolution between the 1780s and the 1820s, precisely the generation before Bessel and Whewell, is the decorporealization of the chemist, the death of the sensuous chemist, as she puts it. Now, I take it that if that kind of story is right, that's an if that kind of story is right, what you see in Whewell, and you do see this in Whewell, is the assignment to the list of secondary qualities, of qualities which up till then were absolutely not taken as secondary, but as fundamental, primary, and given quite directly under the regime of measurement. That's to say, essential qualities of bodies whatsoever, as they are in Newton, right? So there is a historicity about what goes to what side of the bifurcation. However, what one can also say, and this was the matter of dispute, for one of the matters of dispute, for example, between Whewell in his more Kantian moods and his greatest philosophical critic, John Stuart Mill, is what is primary is going to be what is subjectable to the regime of calculation. I mean, to be far too superficial and trivial in a series of lectures sponsored by Trinity, it's as if primary qualities are what you set on the maths tripos. And secondary qualities don't occur on the exam papers in the Senate House. You do not have questions about chromatics, which is what Whewell calls the science of colour, in the tripos. You do have, you start to have, questions by the 1850s and 60s about electricity and magnetism, precisely because they have become proper to a certain kind of mathematical dynamics, absent anything like a qualitative judgment. That's one way of making sense of what's going on. The final point, which again, I see what you meant about answering questions in advance, right? I'm going to say quite a lot more about this. The final point is, think again about what's going on in those transit observations. Those transit observations that I evoked very briefly with Smythe at the telescope are, after all, the extraordinary gesture of combining the sound of a pendulum clock just there next to your right ear and the relatively slowly moving image of a star across the horizontal line as it's cut by the five or seven verticals. That's an eye, that's called the eye and ear method. And that method will become what psychologists call a complication experiment in Wundt's labs and elsewhere from the 1860s and 70s. The first experimental psychology labs are simply transit meridian observatories with artificial stars in them. And the first psychology subjects are simply transit astronomers whose parts are being played by German psychology students. So the answer to the question, what is a primary and what is a secondary quality, will, it turns out, be pursued in experimental detail using exactly the kind of institutional practices that we've been thinking about today. But I want to say a little more about that when I talk about optical discipline in 2 weeks' time.
Thank you. I think we must draw this to a close. Thank you very much indeed, Senator.